HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.
Okay, so today I am joined by Lee Sinnott, and Lee is Commercial Lead for Aon Human Capital Solutions. Lee, thanks for joining the HR Headquarters podcast. How are you today?
Good, Declan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Lee, we're going to talk about the EU Pay Transparency Directive. Before we do that, why don't you just introduce yourself, what you do and what Aon do?
Yeah, happy to. I'm Lee Sinnott. I'm the Commercial Lead for Aon's Human Capital Solutions team. That's talent, health and wealth. And more specifically, we look after assessment, rewards and advisory. So a little bit of everything that helps businesses make better people decisions.
Excellent. EU Pay Transparency Directive. I think people are probably in HR are broadly aware of it. Well, hope they are. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about it, what its impacts will be and what the sort of the key watch outs are?
Of course. I'm going to assume people have a little bit of knowledge that it's coming down the line. I've been referring to it as the Gender Pay Gap 2.0. It is essentially the next steps of legislation to make the gap smaller between men and women when it comes to gender pay gap. The gender pay gap legislation is great, but it's just not closing that gap quick enough. So the EU pay transparency legislation is basically bringing the public sector transparency private.
And you say it's coming. What's the timeline?
So currently with the gender pay gap, this is year two for legal entities above 250. Next year, by the end of this December, 150 plus will have to report. Next year is going to be 50 plus as a legal entity. And then 6 months after that is when the EU pay transparency legislation kicks in. So it's going to be July 2025.
And why do you think the measures up until now haven't maybe closed it as much as would have been ideal?
I think there's too many variables outside of just gender that are leading into this gap. So essentially, if we think about the practice of pay parity, and what pay parity is, it's paying employees fairly without discrimination, regardless of gender or any other characterization or circumstances. So the first step getting to pay parity is the gender pay gap. Next is pay equity. And then that's when the pay transparency comes in. So gender pay gap was always going to be the first step on a bit of a journey here for everybody. It wasn't just going to be a one fix all. It's not just a little plaster you can put over and say, hey, we're done it. With the gender pay gap as well, it's done in quartiles. So it's quartile reporting, the difference between men and women, a little bit of BIK, where the EU pay transparency legislation goes that little bit further in everyday practice and in reporting annually.
And just explain to me, when you say it's done in quartile, just enlighten me.
So essentially, we're just splitting down the headcount into the first 25th percentile, the 50th, the 75th and 75th above. And that's where it's being reported at.
Okay, yeah. So it's quite broad with
very,
that.
Very broad. With the EU that approach, transparency, yeah. We're going to look at it level by level.
Yeah. Okay, so it's coming in our direction, depending on size of organization. What should organizations be doing now with that in mind as to what they will need to ultimately report on?
Of course. Well, let me set the scene a little bit about what the actual directive brings in. So it creates a comprehensive system for tackling pay discrimination at work and contributes to closing the gender pay gap. So the lack of transparency in the gender pay gap has been identified as one of the key obstacles to actually closing the gap. And currently it stands as a 2022 figures, about 9.6% in Ireland. But if we talk about then that there's further legislation coming in around the pension pay gap as well. So even if we talk about the long-term impact and the quality of women's life and their risk to exposure of poverty because of the pension pay gap, it's not just what they're being paid now, it's the impact that has down the future, down the line. So that's with the directive, there's a couple of other branches that come in. So advertising job roles, for example. Organizations are going to have to advertise the base salary, and it can't just be a big range of say, hey, it's 50 to 500,000. It has to be backed by a tried and testing leveling system and job architecture. It has to be very, very transparent, because not only do you have to advertise that role, any potential candidate or any employee of that organization also has the right to request what any other member of the organization at that level is being remunerated and how they're being remunerated. So again, if we think about the old kind of saying that get in the public sector, it's a job for life. You know what you get each year. You know what your pension is. You know exactly what you have to do to get to the next level or to keep what you're getting, essentially. And that's what's coming into the private sector. It is that public sector transparency. So with that in mind, they can't advertise a big range and say, yeah, you fit in there somewhere. It has to be strictly KPI backed, which also means discretionary bonuses are a thing of the past. You can't have someone just say, yeah, he did really well, we're going to give him a big bonus. Unless everybody has the exact same KPIs, then it's not fair. So discretionary bonuses out the window. It's all going to be really, really tightly managed by this KPI tracking. So with that idea, the transparent job architecture, that leveling, that's where that comes into play, because that's where employers create their salary banding around these levels, and the responsibilities of that role or the impact on that role on the organization, that's where that leveling matches up to. But it also means then that it creates essentially an open conversation around what skills are important to that role and how those skills impact that role and why those skills are a priority or where they are on the list of priority to an employer. But it also means that it gets to track what skills have a premium. So it shows that if somebody wanted to upskill, what skills are important for them to take into consideration to get to that next level. It then also means that companies or organizations, if they're being clever about it, will open up the learning and development side of things and start bringing those skills in-house and upskilling in-house. So there's a great opportunity for staff to upskill. There's a great opportunity for organizations not to pay that premium on a skill that they can train someone else onto. And then all of a sudden, there's that skill shortage that we're hearing everybody talk about is getting that little bit smaller and smaller. So there's a great opportunity here with EU pay transparency around just exactly what it says in the title. Transparency does exactly what it says in the tin. That's the key to it.
So much to unpack from what you just said. I'm just gonna have a little panic attack first, though, just so I can when I absorb all of that. A couple of things from what you said, just in no particular order. I'm aware of the pension pay gap, and I understand what you're saying. Will you just explain what that is for anyone who mightn't be just aware of what that is?
Yep, absolutely. So essentially, the pension pay gap is the gap at the end of the life of a pension. So when somebody starts drawing down, when they've retired and they're well into using that pension, the difference between a man's pension and a woman's pension at the moment for similar jobs is huge. We're looking at a 35% gap in the Irish market at the moment, which means like for like over the lifelong of this individual working. It's not saying that any one year we're looking at the gap, but over the lifetime of the pension, there's a 35% gap between men and women. That's going to leave some disparity. Again, even when we get on, as retirement age gets pushed out further and further, we're really kind of focusing on the private pensions here as well. So if you can imagine your private pension, if you and your partner then decide to retire at the same time and you've worked the same amount of years and all of a sudden she's getting paid 35% less than you were for equal work, it leaves everybody in a rough position.
Yeah, and am I correct in saying that the main driver of that is because of the gender pay gap and then percentage contributions by employers and employees?
Correct, exactly. So it's that compounding impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and in fairness, I was aware of it, but I'm only, you know, aware of it in the last number of years, and it's one that people mightn't be as aware of as the normal gender pay gap. You mentioned there as well just that anyone would have the right to have the same salary for doing the same job effectively. Sorry, I'm paraphrasing you there.
And they'd have the right to query what that is and the KPI behind it.
Okay.
And it goes that little bit further as well. So when an employer advertises a role, let's say I'm applying for a role, I go into the interview and that interviewer asks me, what are you currently on? And they'll say, great, we'll give you a 10% increase on that. That's out the window. It's no longer allowed. So essentially, they have to be making an offer for remuneration that is in line with their job architecture. So it's not, oh, I can get this guy for cheap, or I have to pay a premium for this individual to get him in. So for example, let's say you and I are in the same company and they hire a third person in that's doing our same job. And they hire them in at a $5,000 bigger base salary. Essentially, if they were practicing pay parity in the right way, we would also get a $5,000 increase because that's what the market rate is for our role.
Gotcha.
And likewise, instead of saying if we were getting that a certain amount and somebody applies for that role and they say, great, but we give them $5,000 less, they're coming in at a lower step than us for doing the same amount of work. So with that advertising of the role, the base salary, sorry, linked to the job architecture, and everybody's pay and bonuses being linked to job architecture and a clear leveling system that's completely irrelevant to this particular individual, for example. Yeah. So regardless of this individual's gender, race, ethnicity, anything like that, it's what impact does this role have on the organization and the individuals doing that role. That's where the level is.
And I presume the job architecture will take account of experience in some shape or form. So I heard a funny story quite recently about a locksmith, master locksmith, and used to get call outs to open people's doors, and he'd open it in like 2 minutes because he was so skilled, but his tips were always awful. But the longer he'd take, the better his tip would be, because people perceived there was way more effort involved. So how does someone's skills get factored in, or what's the best practice there?
That's where it gets a little bit more complicated, and that's when we start talking about pay policy and going into the architecture a bit more detail. But essentially, you'd be looking at the upper end and the lower end of the scale connected to that level, or being paid on at percentiles. So for example, if the standard pay policy for most companies is we'll pay right at the median, right down the middle of what the market data says to us, you might then go to the 55th, the 60th, the 65th, the 70th percentile for those extra years of experience. You're still playing within that level. But the reason being, the experience is going to impact that job and how it's being done by the individual. But the experience isn't going to impact the constraints that role has on the organization.
Gotcha. What should companies be doing now to get ready for this?
Plain and simple, and I know it's going to sound a little silly, but practice. Start doing it now. The more effort that's put in now, and I'll return to the word effort in a second, but the more practice and the more attempts you do at it, and the more you get it wrong, the more you get it right. You don't want to get it wrong when you legally have to report it. You want to get it right when you have to report it. So obviously down to the head count, there's going to be different implications. So 250 plus for the gender pay gap is an annual report, 150 this year in December, and then it's going to be 3 years before they have to report again. And same with the head count 50 plus. So there's a little bit of time to get ready for it. There is that bit of time to practice and really get used to it without taking up too much time. But there is an operational burden. One kind of bit of advice I'd give, and that's seen it through a couple of my clients, for example, is the first iteration of the report might be handled in-house, and then it might be moved to a centralized team in a different country. And the disconnect from the in-country HR and the individuals that are under certain payroll codes, whether it be sick leave or maternity leave, because that's what we're really comparing here, is those payroll codes. That little bit of a disconnect can slow down those calculations a little bit. So, and that's not to say that people have control over that, because if your boss says, listen, your team's not doing it anymore, just fill out the Excel sheet, pass it on, and we're going to do a big centralized report, your audit trail is key. All the audit trail, any decision that's been made. If I could give one piece of advice on what makes the biggest impact going forward operationally, not on the organization, but actually in the nitty gritty of doing the report, is your audit trail should be so comprehensive that somebody who has never seen this gender pay gap before can read that audit trail and pick it up and run with it straight away. Because it needs to be bulletproof, the rationale and the reasoning why you're comparing what you're comparing to payroll code wise. Some companies that have grown through acquisitions or grown over time very, very quickly may have an abundance of payroll codes for different teams that are all very, very similar. So having a really, really detailed audit trail and a handover document when different teams are doing it, that's key to keeping the workflow and it on track.
Okay, yeah, really, really sensible tips there. What's the penalty if companies get it wrong?
So it will depend on the legislative body and kind of what they decide, but it's always going to be a financial penalty. Let's face it, and any of these are going to hurt your pocket, and that's where we're going to hit. And I think as well that some companies, some people will say, well, it's an operational risk. I think it might be worth keeping the team the way we are and taking that kind of penalty or the fine on the chin. But with the more and more legislation that passes and these more directives, we're going to have more reports to do, whether it's down to racial reporting or neurodiversity reporting. There's no way any one company can take these on these blows over and over again on the chain. Yeah. When it comes to the fine, everyone's going to have to report sooner or later. Now, if there's a big, for example, they do report and find there's a huge big gap, they still have to then draft an action plan with the help of the staff and publish that action plan. So it's not just a case of, yeah, let's report. We know we have a gap. Big deal. Who cares? We'll just keep on going. You have to, there is, it's not just a, okay, we'll let them away with it. There's your fine, pay the fine and keep doing what you're doing. There is changed behavior here. There's parts of the legislation that are forcing companies to move with the times, essentially. Let's face it, that's the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
So there's reasons, there's very, very good reasons beyond the financial burden or the penalties around like creating an action plan. They're minimal. The benefits it brings in relation to your talent pipeline, your ability to attract and retain talent, it's so much bigger than the financial.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you that, actually. Good segue, Lee. I was literally just about to ask you, I see benefits from an employee's point of view, although I'm sure maybe there's some negatives I just haven't thought of. What are those? And you just started touching on them, like talent. What are the big benefits that you see for the organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first I'll hit on what potentially could be a negative for the individual, which kind of segues into being a positive for the organization. Is if you're in a situation where you're seeing advertisements around you for your role and they're more money than you're being paid. Let's face it, sometimes it just hits you and hits you hard, it catches in your throat, and it can just kind of stump you a little bit. That, but being said, that also on the flip side puts all the responsibility on the organization to say, well, if everybody else is advertising their roles and all of my staff can see whether they're being underpaid, I much rather those company advertise their roles with the base and my staff saying we get paid better. So there's, although it could potentially lead into something where someone says, right, I feel like I'm being underpaid and hitting that little bit of a burnout stage, the onus on companies and the impact it has on companies and organizations is so much more that they're not going to risk that. They're going to put it into action as quick as possible. So if we think of the benefits for organizations, a little bit of a plug for the risk team in Aon, they launched the Global Risk Management Survey, and that basically asked C-suites, what are your biggest fears? What do you think are the biggest risks going forward in 2024? Which is, globally, number four was attracting and retaining talent. And when you can imagine all the things that are on the plate of the C-suite between insurance and operations, everything else, attracting and retaining talent typically sits with HR. We're now seeing it at board level. This is a big issue. If we go further down the line, UK and Ireland, it was classed as number two. So attraction and retaining talent is a huge priority for every organization at the moment. And this legislation, by forcing so much transparency, everybody likes to know what they're getting, what they're worth, what their value is. That transparency leads to more confidence in the organization from their employees, more satisfaction, less burnout, and as a result, less turnover. You know, so, and again, even if we're talking about that level of transparency, if you have your job architecture and your pay all linked together, you're the type of organization that also uses benchmarking to decide your salary increases. So then all of a sudden you're not feeling like your end of year review is, I have to fight and argue for what I'm getting. It's, no, here's the transparency. This is what you're getting. A bit like if we listen to the news today, the public sector pay increases. They know exactly what they're getting for the next 2 years, and that's what brought them back to the table with the goal. It's the same thing here. Like I said, we're bringing that public sector transparency private. It benefits everybody. It benefits the organization from knowing exactly what their spend is. No little hidden kind of increases this year. They know what inflation is. They know what the salary increases in market is. They know exactly what their pay is and how much their operational cost for people is every year. And as employees, we know that we're valued, what our worth is, what we need to do to get to the next level if we want to advance. We also know then when we're not being paid right, when we're not being honored in an agreement, or we're not being valued as much as we feel we should, because we can see online that, hey, look, here's my role and here's what's being paid.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. What do you think companies' approaches will be to this in terms of building out that architecture, making sure they're getting it all right? Is this a technology solution? Is this a spreadsheet solution? Does it depend on the size of the organization? What do you think is the way forward to make sure you're hitting all of those key bits?
Of course. Well, listen, first of all, it's a mindset change first. You know, there's going to have to be, it's a big change management piece. It's a lot of communication that's involved, from getting buy-in from the C-suite level and board level for some of the options that are going, getting manager buy-in and getting the general buy-in from everybody that this is the right step in the direction. There is going to be some pain points, like I said. We're going to lift the veil a little bit here. We're going to peek under the hood and see what's really going on. So, of course, when you're, it's like buying a house. When you're doing a survey, you always find some little bits. It's about are they manageable bits to deal with and move on and get the house the way you want it. So we're getting houses in order. Like I said, for individuals, you might feel like you're a little bit underrewarded if it comes out that you're being paid the least. But there's some members of your team that feel like they're getting paid more than you for doing the same job. So from an individual level, there's going to be that little bit of pain. From an organization level, there's going to be need an investment. There's going to be investment of time. There's going to be investment in operational time and costing. And there's going to be the financial investment in actually attacking the pay equity problems and what equality issues are. Whether that's technology or advisory, it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. It depends on the size of your organization, the type of teams you have. If you've got loads of data analysts, I'm sure you'd be able to manage it quite well, doing the actual calculations, identifying your gaps and controlling those variables so that you can see, wait, if we control for the years of experience, the education level, the tenure in the organization, here's the real outliers, here are the gaps where we're not paying equally. This is whether it's a 20% spread above or below, and whatever your outliers are. Once it's transparent, everybody knows what where they are, where they're going, and where they're coming from, essentially. So it's not going to be just an easy plug in your data, here's a solution, on your pop. This is something we're going to have to live and breathe. It's going to have to come into organizations' core pillars of what they believe in. And whether it's, if we look at it through an ESG lens or an employee value proposition lens, it has to be a part of the day in, day out runnings of any organization.
And Lee, as someone who is an expert in the area, do you think it will achieve the ultimate goal of bridging that gap?
I think it's going to make it most of the way there. I think, again, if we look at the, and again, this is a very oversimplification, but one of the biggest leaders of the gender pay gap is maternity leave and paternity leave and the differences in them. It's still, I mean, just as a society, it's still a struggle to get men to take their parental leave, you know?
The maternity that penalty.
Exactly. It's back to that. It's back to the kind of a societal issue. And that's when I go back and say, we need to start living and breathing this. It needs to be pure equality, which is, it's very hard to achieve. So is this going to get there? I'd hope so. Everybody hopes so. Is it likely to stamp out equality? No, nothing's going to truly stamp out equality. No.
Sure. Lee, thank you so much. That was really, really insightful. If people want help in this area or they want to chat to you a bit more about it, or how can they get in contact?
Absolutely. So straight onto the Aon Ireland website. You can just pop in your details and reach out or find me on LinkedIn, anything like that. We're always open. We're always around. Obviously, Aon is so wide. And if there's any sort of business that you do with us, don't be afraid to just tell your account manager, hey, these are the issues. They'll yellow pages me and get me right in front of you, no problem.
Great stuff, and we'll link your contact details obviously below the podcast. Lee Sinnott is commercial lead for Aon Human Capital Solutions. Lee, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Declan. Been a pleasure.
HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.